Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I'm happy to be here today. It's been such an emotional week. I've been at jury duty for a federal criminal case, and I've been serving on jury as an alternate, and it's been tremendously emotional, and it's made me think of so many things, and I've been connecting the dots with my own actions, my own work, and how things happen with crimes. I kept thinking of the bigger picture. Fortunately, I didn't have to deliberate. I was an alternate, and I'm not quite sure yet how the case came out. Of course, I'm not allowed to talk about the case until it's over. But between that and what happened with the testimony this week with the Supreme Court candidate Kavanaugh and the testimony of Dr. Ford, it's been a very emotional time. And I might talk about some of that later and connect it to food, because it's all about food. But right now, I have a very special guest, and I can't wait to chat with him. My guest is Tobias Lennert, and he is the author of a book, How to Create a Vegan World. He's a longtime speaker, trainer, strategist, and the co-founder of the Belgian organization EVA, Ethical Vegetarian Alternative, the first vegetarian vegan organization to receive structural funding from a national government. Under Tobias's management, EVA launched a successful campaign that resulted with the city of Ghent becoming the first city to ever officially support a weekly vegetarian day. Tobias gives animal advocacy trainings worldwide together with Melanie Joy for the Center of Effective Vegan Advocacy. He's also the co-founder of ProVeg, an international pro-veg organization with the mission to reduce the global consumption of animals by 50% by the year 2040. Tobias lives in Ghent, Belgium, with his partner, two dogs and six cats, and he blogs at veganstrategist.org. Bonsoir. Welcome to It's All About Food. Good evening. How are you, Tobias?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So I've been reading your book, and I was explaining to my audience that I've been serving on a jury for the last week for a criminal trial. And it really was an emotional experience. And I couldn't help but think of the bigger picture, like not whether these people committed a crime or not, but how they got to this place. And how it's been centuries, or if not more, of exploitation and all kinds of opportunities gone wrong or not available to people that led them to this place. And it was just a very difficult time. And, you know, I think about how animals are treated and what we do in this world. And it's really a challenge to stay on top of things and stay focused and stay strong and not have burnout. You talk about burnout in the book, but it was an especially emotional time. And so reading your book was very helpful, kind of to keep me grounded while I was on breaks, and reminding me of the skills that are important to have in order to communicate our message. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so talk about the book and why you wrote it, and it's been out for about a year now, and what the feedback has been since you put it out there.
Mm-hmm. So this book was written in main part to help people who are already vegan, vegetarian, and who want to actually make this a reality for everybody, who want to create a vegan world. And I thought there was a lot of improvement possible in the communication of the people who are already on our side, at least some people. And what I wanted to do with this book was to provide some kind of like let's say, theory of change, of why an incremental, more soft and kind approach works and would lead to the same goal that people who call themselves abolitionist vegans or just vegans have, which is to say the abolition of all of the use of animals for food and other purposes. I'm hoping to show that different strategies and different roads can lead to the same goal. And so in particular, in my book, I have talked about reduction as a way of communication or as a message to ask people, asking them to reduce rather than to go vegan, because I think that it's an easier ask. More people will do it. And if more people do it, if we have a critical mass of people doing that, the result will be that demand will increase, supply will increase, and it will become easier and easier for everybody to go vegan because we have many more products. And then another point is that we don't always have to talk about the animals and always have to talk about moral issues, but we can also talk about other things like health and taste. And it doesn't really matter what we start with. It doesn't really matter what arguments we use, because people evolve in their arguments. And even if they don't do it for the right reasons, which for us, for animal rights people, are animal reasons, it becomes easier to think about the animals and to accept the animal arguments once you're already experiencing how good vegan food is, or you're experiencing how great it is for your health. So that's just in a nutshell some things of why I wrote it and what's in it. And the response has been very good. I think I get really a lot of people who tell me by email that this book changed them, changed their approach. It's been translated into Spanish now, and it's going to be translated in more languages. So I'm very happy with the result and with the feedback that I've been getting.
Wonderful. Well, I'm having some technical stuff here. I'm trying to deal with myself. Okay. I'm not sure when you started your vegan vegetarian journey. Can you tell me that?
Yeah, so I was about 10 or 12 years old when I was, I think, thinking for the very first time about the difference between the dog that was lying near the fireplace in our house and the cow that was in the meadow across the road in the rain. And I was wondering, like, what is the difference that justifies for me that I pet the one and eat the other? The morally relevant difference that tells me, okay, it's okay to treat these animals of these different species so differently. And I couldn't find an answer. And I said, so, okay, if I can't see a difference, then I should stop eating animals. And the problem was that I loved eating animals. I loved eating meat. I ate meat every time I could find it. And it was only at university when somebody gave me Peter Singer's Animal Liberation that I read that, and that I gradually started to understand more and more and feel more and more and get more and more involved. And then I wrote my thesis at university about this topic. And then I went to the United States for half a year. I'm from Belgium. I went to the United States for half a year to do internships at animal rights organizations. When I came back, I found an organization. I led that for 15 years, a nonprofit in Belgium. And then I started working on myself, the book, blogs, a lot of talks all over the world. And I work together with Melanie Joy, giving trainings to vegan and vegetarian advocates everywhere.
And about how long has that been?
So this whole process, I mean, I started the organization. I was vegan in 98. I became vegan in 98, 20 years ago. I started an organization in 2000, and I led it till 2015, and then I got out. And so for 2 or 3 years now, I have been traveling the world and speaking, writing also, mainly to or for an audience of people who are already on our side of the fence.
Okay, so it's been a 20-year journey or so, and a lot's changed. I've been vegan for 30 years, and I've seen so much change. Mm-hmm. And I think we've learned a lot over those 3 decades. But I also think it's been important to changed the strategy over the last 30 or more years as more people are more accepting about vegans and vegetarians. There may not be a great many that call themselves vegan and vegetarian, but more people are familiar with vegans and vegetarians and what the concept is. More people are aware of what's going on with the treatment of animals than 20 or 30 or more years ago. And so I think our strategy can be adjusted. And what I mean by that is, I really appreciate everything you put in the book, and it's, I often say love is the only answer. We have to come from a place of respect and kindness when we're engaging with anyone, whether we agree with them or not. But I did feel, some people used to call me a militant vegan when I was starting out. Mm-hmm. And I've probably taken a softer approach since that time. But I did feel that it was important to speak out. And you've brought up many different examples, and I'm sure it depends on the individual example, but I felt guilty many times when you were describing different situations in the book. So I have been the kind of person that in a restaurant, if I wasn't served something that was completely vegan, if it had a little bit of cheese or something, I would politely take it back and explain. I always try to explain before I'm served what it is I need. But I think it was more important 30 years ago than perhaps it is today, because nobody really knew about veganism back then. And it was kind of, it was the awareness was just very different. So some of that, I think, has changed, and it has enabled me to even have a softer approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, just to your point of sending the dish with the cheese back in the restaurant, this is actually the most controversial point in my book and the one I get the most critical feedback on. I mean, what I say in the book is that like we shouldn't be too rigid because that can backfire. And I don't want to tell anybody to not send a dish with cheese, which you didn't ask for, back to the kitchen. In fact, I would do so myself. I mean, I couldn't eat it. And the exceptions that I can make are even tinier ones than that. So if I would sense like a little bit of butter maybe, or a tiny bit of mayonnaise or something in something, then if I suspect something wrong, but I'm not really sure, then I might give it the benefit of the doubt. But the thing is, there's ways in which to communicate all this. Ways to not to make a scene, but to certainly give your message. And what I mean, the core of my message here is that we should be mindful of the image we create of veganism and of being vegan. And if we create an image of veganism as something very difficult and almost unobtainable for normal people, then we're not doing the animals a service. We have to create an image, I think, of veganism as something that is very doable. And not as something that is only for superhumans. And so that's why I say, like, look, in certain circumstances, it might be the pragmatic, the wise thing to do, the best thing to do for animals, to swallow it, as it were. And I'm not talking about even about cheese, or certainly not about meat, but about some things that, I mean, it differs from people to people. So some will say, like, look, I don't mind if it has this or this this time because... yeah, whatever, you know, I don't want to make a scene here. And other people will say like, well, I do mind, and but this little thing I don't mind, you know. So it differs for different people. In any case, I don't want to tell anybody how to eat, but I'm saying like, be mindful of the impact or the image that you create of veganism, of vegans, and make sure that it's something that other people say, of look, I could do this. This could be something for me. And I'm afraid that in our communication often today, we don't create that image. We create an image of something very difficult where people say, like, oh my God, I could never do this. This is so hard. This brings me into socially awkward situations, etc. So that's what I mean with that.
Yes, I totally understand. We are a very interesting species. And we have a lot of different challenges. And you talk about how important it is to empathize, how it's important to understand the other person that we might be communicating with, the individual or the group. You have, they're almost games or some fun things to try. I wanted to read some of them where you you talk about Yanya, how you are not your audience, and you try to imagine what omnivores might feel, and you give certain statements, and I wanted to read some of them because I've like experienced all of them, of course. President Clinton being touted as a vegan in the newspaper but eating fish. You know, that brings up so many different things, and it's great to think about it and imagine what omnivores would feel, because we were all so excited when Clinton said he was a vegan and then disappointed when he started eating fish. But there were so many good things about what he did, and many people still call him a vegan, not understanding the subtle differences. And your point is about getting more people to consume less animals, and they don't have to be 100% anything, because it's impossible actually to be 100% vegan. And you clarified that very well in the book. It's just a very, very interesting balance. I've talked to numerous people on this show. Some of them are abolitionists and some of them are welfarists, and it's a wide range. But you know what I think? I think it's important to have all of us in the party, all kinds. Tell me what you think of this, because as we're trying to move the of what people consider normal in terms of eating, we want that normal to be consuming less animals because there'll be less suffering. And I think there needs to be a framework of people that are more, I hate to use the word, more extreme. And that helps kind of move the normal a little over to where we want it to be when there's a further away place to go.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, this what you're describing is called the radical flank effect, where a more radical faction of a movement can create a context in which the general audience says, like, okay, but I mean, these guys are really, really radical, but in the light of that, compared to them, now this other group seems like really very reasonable. And so because this radical message or these radical people exist, the less radical people who are still quite radical compared to general audience seem more reasonable. And that definitely can happen. The opposite thing can also happen. And that is that, well, people are going to identify the more reasonable people with the radicals. And they will say, like, look, all vegans are like these guys from Animal Liberation Front. So it can go both ways, and it's dangerous to trust too much on that effect, I think. But to your point of, like, we need everybody, I mean, my first concern is let's try not to mind read other people and say that other kinds of activists who have other messages, that they're not in it for the right reasons. You know, I get a lot of that from some people, like people saying, like, look, he wants to sell his book and he does it for attention and he does it for this and that and doesn't care about the animals. All kind of, like, kind of sometimes nasty and mean messages. And it goes in the other direction too, I'm sure. But I think, I mean, if we are charitable towards each other as activists and assuming that everybody does it for the right reasons and wants to get to the same place, which is true for most people, we just all want abolition. If we can accept that we just have different strategies to get there, we'd be so much more productive and peaceful together. So that's one important thing. And the other thing is that, yes, we do need different approaches, and there cannot be just one right approach because people are so different and society is so complicated. We need more than one. But on the other hand, let's not also get too lazy and just say, like, look, everything works. Let's just do anything. You know, that's too cheap and too easy as well, because we have limited resources. And we can sometimes know that one thing works better than another thing. We have some research and we're doing more and more research and more funding is going to research. So it is definitely possible to look for what works better. And then I think it's good to do the thing that we know or we think works better. And also let's not forget that some things might actually be turning some people off, turning some people away. So even if you think that or you perceive that some strategy attracts a couple of people, remember that there's a possibility that it turns off many more people. So we have to do research. We have to be able of the effects of our actions. We cannot just do things that feel good to us, things that like that are right in theory to us. We have to look at impact, at results. That's the most important thing. I think that's what the animals would want from us. They don't want our purity or adhering to a certain philosophy. They just want us to get results for them. And results are that people eat less animal products and less animal products are produced. That's, I think, the bottom line.
That is the bottom line. It's unfortunate that as a vegan, we think of ourselves as kind and compassionate, and yet there's so much anger, and there are a lot of nasty vegans out there spewing all kinds of hate and being so judgmental, and that doesn't help anyone. You talk about people wanting to be part of the club, the vegan club, the vegetarian club, and identity with a group is important for a lot of people. It's not important for everyone, but it is for some, and it can have positive and negative ramifications. So people want to be a part of the club, and maybe they don't want everybody else in the club. You know, they want to feel special that they're in the club. On the other hand, you talk about how it's important for many people to be around like-minded people to get the support that they need. Mm-hmm. So how do we balance that?
It is. So on the one hand, an identity, group identity is a good thing because it gets you closer together and you may follow the rules of the group more. And hopefully these are reasonable rules and not like rigid rules. But so for that, it's very good. And you can say like, look, I'm a vegan. I identify as a vegan. And that may help you to be more sustainable as a vegan, may help you to be a vegan longer, because we do know that there's a lot of vegetarians and vegans who give up vegetarian or vegan after a while. So that's the good side. The bad side, of course, or the downside is that, well, if there's an in-group or a group, there's an out-group, and there's people who don't belong to it. And sometimes the in-group and the out-group, they're like kind of like opposed, and then it becomes like an us versus them thing. And people who are outside of the group don't have any desire anymore to join the group. And the group is seen as like a very small elitist group with certain rules, and it's not attractive to join them. And what I say in the book is, I think it's a quote from Matt Ball, we don't want a vegan club, we want a vegan world. So identity is really a dangerous thing in some ways. And I'm in favor of not attaching too much importance to it. And I think it's especially important if you're like a young or a recent vegan. Then you identify very much with that. But I think many vegans experience, at least I have experienced that after a while, for instance, those vegan festivals and vegan groups, etc., they become less and less necessary for you and less interesting, maybe because you are secure in your veganism. This is something you just do. It becomes a very natural thing, and you don't need to look up that environment all the time, and you don't need that support all the time. But definitely in the beginning, when maybe your veganism is not so consolidated, these groups and these events, etc., and gatherings, they're definitely useful to help you consolidate that way of living and eating more. And today we live in a society where only 1% of people are vegan. So we are very much going against the stream. Society is not always accommodating to us. So we definitely can use some support, some structure. We can use other people who are going the way together with us. That's absolutely helpful.
I'm playing with some dials while we talk back and forth. I didn't quite make my setup as best as I could today. I'm trying out some new equipment. Anyway, what I loved you quoting, I think it was Freud, when you said the narcissism of small differences.
Yes.
And it's really important to acknowledge when we do pick out or judge for people that are not really doing things right, quote, right, or the way we think that they should do them, or, well, just talk about the narcissism of small differences. Can you do that?
Yeah, so the narcissism of small differences is indeed a term by Freud, and he used that to indicate the idea that when there's two groups and they're differing just a little bit from each other, when compared to the outgroup, to the general audience, let's say, then often these very little differences between these two different groups are going to become very important all of a sudden. And so you see this phenomenon in many situations or in many contexts, like you have different kinds of Christians or different kind of Muslims who are fighting each other more than they're fighting the outside world. So, and this happens also among vegans, like, so vegans among themselves have so much in common, at least when compared to the outside world that is not vegan, not vegetarian, and is just eating animals every day, etc. But still these little differences, relatively little small differences between those different kind of vegans become very important, and people are going to emphasize them. So for instance, you have vegans who do it for this reason, and you have the health vegans. And actually, the ethical vegans call themselves the real vegans, call themselves the only vegans, and the health vegans are not supposed to be called or to calling themselves vegans, because vegans is by definition something ethical. So that's an example of the narcissism of small differences. And what, according to Freud and other people, was going on here is that is something that is called distinctiveness threat. And it means that your identity that is important to you is most threatened by the people closest to you. So closest to you in terms of like they're very close to you in ideology, but not exactly the same. And these people are more of a threat than the people who are totally different from you. And I think we can see this in our vegan movement, that that people who have different opinions, like the people who are reductionist, who have incremental opinions, are kind of like sometimes diametrically opposed or the other way around to the people who have these abolitionist ideas, abolitionist in communication. I mean, like that all communication, all asks, all messages should be abolitionist. And when you look at it from the outside, it's kind of silly, because they're both groups that don't consume animal products. But then, they have sometimes very harsh differences in opinion. That's apparently human. I wish we could do something about it. I wish we wouldn't have to have that. But apparently it's something very human, something that happens whenever there's groups present.
I felt that kind of power in identity when it was a raw vegan. So for about 2 years, I ate only raw food, and I went to a number of raw food conferences and festivals. And I recognized it was an important time, because I was able to recognize feeling this superiority, like holier than thou, because I was doing this certain thing, and purity. And it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I recognized it, because I'm just back to being a whole food, plant-based kind of vegan. You know, there's so many different ways to identify ourselves today. I recognize that we can't, it's not about us. Like you say, you are not your audience. It's not about us. We have to remember why we started this to begin with. It's about reducing pain and suffering, eliminating pain and suffering, especially for the voiceless, the exploited. And it's not about us, and it's not about purity, and it's not about following the rules. And it's hard sometimes. You can get so wrapped up in the identity.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, the different groups are going to tell each other it's about the animals, it's not about us, and every group actually says that. Again, I don't want to like mind read and attribute wrong intentions to anybody who's in this movement, because we're all doing it for animals. But it is something we should be very mindful of, that we could fall into the trap of identifying and of labels and of details and of rigidity and purity. These are all quite ineffective and dangerous things. Dangerous because they don't lead to more impact or more results for animals. And we're in a world today where 75 billion animals every year are killed for food alone. And in that kind of scenario, in that kind of situation, really it's these fights over these details, over this last percent of veganism, is these fights are so futile and so useless and so fruitless. And we have to focus, I think, right now on the big picture and on the big change. And we have to leave the final 1% of being vegan for later. And for now, make sure that we have a message that is as attractive for people as possible to get on the wagon, not necessarily to become vegan, because we're so obsessed with making people go vegan. We're still at 1 or 2%, probably more closer to 1% of vegans. And really, that's not the important number. That's not the metric we have to focus on. We have to focus on general consumption, on how many people are reducing, how many people are really having an impact on supply and demand through their eating habits. And that number, that's not the vegans, that number is a lot bigger than the vegans. That number is double digits. It's 20% or 30% in some countries. And these are the people, for now, that drive demand the most. So I'm always saying to vegans, look, if it's relatively easy for you to be vegan today, if you have all these products, that's mainly because there were people, there have been people reducing for some time, and they have created the demand. You know, all these soy milks we have, in terms of milk, we have, so non-dairy milks have a 12% market share. So 12% of sales are of fluid milk goes to, or it's represented by non-dairy milks. And of course, we don't have 12% vegans. So all these milks, they're there because some people drink them some of the time for some reason, and it's not necessarily all of the time. It's not necessarily for the right reasons. We think the right reasons, animal reasons. So accept that. Accept that these reducers have a big impact, that they're strategically very important. And so getting people to reduce, and I mean significantly reduce, not just like a burger every, a vegetarian burger, vegan burger every month, even though that makes a difference too, but significantly reduce, like a couple of days, vegan or vegetarian days a week or meals a week, that's really significant. And if we get a lot of people like that, I think, I'm convinced that the system will tip, and that once we reach a certain number of people who are a certain degree of vegan, then from there's no way back. That's a tipping point, and from there everything's going to go much faster. And we're still going uphill right now, but from that tipping point onward, the way to a vegan world is much smoother.
I'm sure you're working with John Gottman's Diet for New America and many other books. He's a close friend of mine, and I'm fortunate to work with him and his son at the Food Revolution Network. And back in 1987, when he wrote his book, Diet for New America, there was a message there that was very important to him, and I don't know that everybody got it. And it's exactly the message that you have, and that is that we would be far more effective if everybody reduced their meat consumption by only 10% rather than making a handful of vegans. And that's really been his message all along. He's never promoted veganism and has struggled on occasion when people called him on doing things that weren't perceived as something a vegan would do. And that was over 30 years ago now, and we're still, it's a slow, slow journey. So I lived in France for 4 years, from 1992 to 1996. There was soy milk in the stores, like one or two brands, and There was access to tofu. But I never met another vegan when I lived there. And I think I met one vegetarian. And then something changed. And I don't know what it is. But now there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe. Can you expand on that or help me understand some of that?
Yeah, I think time is ripe for this idea, and not necessarily for veganism as such, but for eating differently and start to care about animals and the environment and health. And I see this happening everywhere. So I go around the world, I've been on all continents, speaking everywhere, and this is happening everywhere. In some places faster than other places. But I think America especially is leading the way, and then maybe also some other countries in Europe. But it's happening anywhere, everywhere. I think different things happen. One thing is there's new products and new technology that just makes the product better. There is the internet that helps us to spread the message and helps us to raise awareness. And I'm very excited about the fact now, even though some people are really not liking the idea of money and capitalism, but I'm very excited about so many, well, rich people and investment companies putting a lot of money in vegan products and vegan startups. And I think we've never been in that situation before where actually the vegan thing becomes a profitable thing to do, a really profitable thing to do, where you can make a really big company with that. Like, for instance, the company Just, which used to be called Hampton Creek, is a so-called unicorn. That means a very startup that reaches $1 billion in market capitalization. That's incredible. The money that goes to these companies is more money than the entire budget of all the animal rights organizations combined. So the whole business thing is really exploding. And for the first time, profit is also one of the drivers. I mean, we have animals as our driver. We want to decrease suffering, but some people have profit as their driver. And we may not like that, but that's a good thing for the animals. I mean, they will be helped by that. That's something I'm very enthusiastic about, and it's something that is also like really changing the whole playing field. Something is happening, definitely. Many people think like the number of vegans is exploding. That's not yet happening. I think that will happen at some point, but that's not happening yet. But what is exploding is the amount of vegan products, vegan consumption, consumption is growing, and it is growing because many people, many consumers are part-timers, are using these products, even though they're still using other animal-based products. But that doesn't matter. They're creating the demand. They're helping to shift the playing field. They're helping to achieve the tipping point.
You talk about how it's really not possible to be 100% vegan. There are so many products out there that use animals, and it's really impossible to avoid them. But we try to do the best we can. I was thinking about 12 years ago when I had cancer treatment. I was given, I think it's called heparin, and it's like a blood thinner, and it comes from pigs. And I had no idea where it came from. You know, they were just injecting it into my port that I was getting chemotherapy, and I'm going along with it. And sometime later, I realized where it came from, and I was devastated. There was another time when my lips were chapped, and some nurse came along and put some, like a salve on it. And later, when I read the ingredients, it had lanolin in it. And, you know, I don't do those things. And when you're fragile enough going through trying to fight a disease, it's bad enough. But then when you realize things that are kind of going against your ethics are being given to you, it's a really difficult time. And what I did myself was just to meditate on it and put out some loving energy to the animals that have helped contribute to creating these products that have helped myself and other people, but it's just overwhelming, and we can only do the best we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to us, like we have this system of like trying to avoid all animal products, and when something happens to us, like what happened to you in the hospital, there's some kind of like necessary exception or whatever happens, then we feel bad about that, and we feel impure, and we feel like we've done something wrong, and we feel like we hurt somebody maybe, or we were like complicit into something, and these are all very understandable feelings, and I really avoid using any animal product as much as possible. But we have to realize at the same time that one exception is not going to do anything, is not going to bring any animal back, is not going to reduce suffering in itself. And so it might be more interesting here to have like, without becoming complacent, but just relaxing a little bit about this. And like when it happens, you know, there's nothing bad that's going to happen because of that one time thing. And it might be more sustainable for many vegans because, I mean, we know that one of the reasons why some vegetarians and vegans slip back or fall off the wagon, so to speak, is because they experience that as too difficult to keep it up, to be so consistent all the time. But the question is, of course, like how difficult do we want to make it? And for what moment do we say that a vegan is not a vegan anymore? Is it like from making one exception, from doing this one thing that has some animal products inside it, do they not qualify as a vegan anymore? And that's, if we're so rigid and so strict about definitions and labels, then it does become very difficult. And so my idea is like, let's relax a little bit, or maybe let's have different expectations from other people than from ourselves. If we can pluck up everything, all the required energy to be 100% consistent all the time, but let's maybe not expect it from other people. So let's just look at like not just how we follow rules, but again at impact, and impact both for other animals as well as for ourselves, and for how easy it is to continue this lifestyle in spite of going against the tide.
Okay, I have two more questions for you, and they're on the lighter side of things. So, well, it doesn't start light, but it'll end light. And you talk about how vegans can be misanthropes, mm-hmm. people who don't like humans because mm-hmm. of all of the things, the horrible, violent, exploitive things that humans do. It's very true, and it's very difficult, and we see it every day. But you point out that we're also doing some wonderful things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about some of the wonderful things that we're doing to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So like you say, there's a lot of people thinking like, okay, humans spoil everything. They really destroy everything, etc. They're a plague. They should disappear, etc. And so, I mean, you can make a long list of all these horrible things, but I can make a long list of all these wonderful things. And just, I mean, just look at the mere figure of the mere amount of people who work in the nonprofit sector, who work every day, not just to earn a living, but also to help other people, get better or be more comfortable. People who work as nurses in hospitals, people who work in education, people who work to help others in no matter what problems they have, you know. In that sense, we're pretty unique too. I mean, we may be uniquely bad in some ways and uniquely destructive, but we're also uniquely cooperative and uniquely benevolent sometimes towards each other. And we're also doing these things to other species. And I always say, like, look, there's probably, it's hard to find a species in nature that cares about other species so much as we do, in a way. I mean, apart from, of course, the fact that we kill and eat them, but there's more and more people who care about what we do to other species, and that's special. In a way, you could say that we are the first species that questions its own diet. You know, we are people, we are beings, and we evolved from apes, etc. And right now we're taking our food in our hands and we're looking at it and we say, like, look, maybe we shouldn't eat this. Maybe this is bad for us. Maybe this is bad for other beings. And this is a very special moment in evolution to have arrived at. This is beautiful. So I'm not a misanthrope at all. And I know we're doing bad things. And but it's like you said at the beginning, like you were in that trial. And you can always look at, like, where do people come from? What have they experienced that led them up to this point? And I'm not very much a believer in freedom of choice or free will. I think a lot of stuff is determined for us. And I always like to say, it sounds religious, but it doesn't need to be there, but for the grace of God, go I. So I could be in the situation that this other person is. And if I'm at this point aware of what happens to animals and I have the discipline and whatever I need and the money and whatever I need to avoid eating animals, well, I don't know to what extent that this is my own merit, to my own merit. I this is something I've also been given. And some people might say, no, I made a decision and as soon as I watched Earthlings, I stopped, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, okay, maybe you stopped right after watching Earthlings, but how did you become a person who was able to do that? Is that through your own merit, or is that your education or your constitution, your genetics, whatever? So it's always good to, like, imagine yourself in the place of another person and think, like, look, maybe if I was him or her, I wouldn't have done differently. And I think that's a very charitable way of approaching things. And it's something that makes our environment more peaceful. And that also makes ourselves more peaceful to think about people like that. And we don't have to become tolerant of everything and just approve of everything and of every evil that people are doing. But sometimes I think, and especially on social media, it would be good to be a lot more charitable and to just stand still and think, like, look, I don't know what this person has gone through. I don't know their situation. Maybe I would have done the same thing. And I'm going to be as compassionate as I am towards animals.
It's a lovely image. Very difficult to do. Very difficult for many of us, even the ones that know that that's really the ideal thing to do. So we're all on a path. We're all on a journey. My last question is, what is yummy and delicious today in Belgium? What are you enjoying eating most?
Well, actually, I'm trying really to, like, watch what I eat right now, because I've been normally I love eating vegan food and I eat everything and I eat too much, and I'm trying to be a bit more health conscious these days because I'm 45 now and some of my weight is sticking, or some of the food I'm eating is sticking to me, and I'm experiencing for the first time, like, how difficult it can be to eat in a different way that, eat in a way that actually you don't want to eat. I mean, eat different things than what you would ideally like to eat. I would love to eat all these sweets and a lot of food, and I'm trying to, like, be disciplined about it. And when you experience that, you experience again how it might be for other people who are also on a path of change and maybe on a vegan path. It's always good to have this experience of, like, trying to change your food habits, even as a vegan, so that you can see how difficult it is to change your food sometimes. But just to answer your question, I mean, we're experiencing kind of the same thing. I'm in a very friendly, vegan-friendly city in Ghent, in Belgium, and there's more and more options here. There's new ice creams coming up and new cheeses, and it's looking very good. And I've always said that having a lot of options available is really the thing that will facilitate compassion, that will facilitate people opening up to our animal rights arguments. If they don't have an alternative, if they can't see that there's a lot of good food to be had, easy to come by, then they will be deaf to our arguments. So I'm really happy that there's more food and more and more food coming for whatever reason, you know, if it's for health or for sometimes for capitalist reasons or it's a fad or a trend, I don't mind. And the thing is that it's important for people to try that food And I think that there's a lot of chance that when they experience it's good, they will be a lot more open to our arguments and to our awareness-raising attempts.
You brought up some really good points. I've been, as I mentioned, vegan for 30 years and vegetarian for even longer. We just have like a couple minutes left, and I want to wrap this up. But my diet has changed many times over 30 years, and now I'm into this whole food, plant-based, very little oil, little or no sugar and salt, and concentrating on whole foods, minimally processed. But when I was younger, I would rejoice at all of the vegan products that were available. And whenever there was a treat that was available, I couldn't wait to have it. But, you know, now I'm in a different space. I'm focusing on health, and it's always interesting, like you said, to change because you have a little more empathy for other people who are struggling. Yeah. But I just want to put out there before I let you go that if you have any questions about how to get into a cleaner, more leaner diet, you can reach out to me. Okay, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, be well. Thank you, Tobias, author of How to Create a More Vegan World, Tobias Lennart, vegan strategist. Thank you for joining me, everybody. It's been a great hour. I'm glad we got our technical difficulties ironed out. And I'll be back next week with a very special guest, Eric Adams from Brooklyn Borough Hall, our borough president. And I'm looking forward to speaking with him. Join me then, same time. And have a very delicious week, everybody. Bye-bye.